listening to that story of the crucifixion of Jesus, the arrest, the Garden of Gethsemane, you see so many realities happening simultaneously, depending on where you were standing, who you were, how you were feeling it, what you were experiencing. Of course, at the center of it, you have Jesus himself, who hovered, in a sense, over all of it. The anger of the priests who had gotten themselves into such a frenzy that this man was such a threat to their well-being that they had to arrest him and they had to take him and make sure that he was put to death for his blasphemy. Think how intense their passion was against him. I mean, what did Jesus do? He existed. He brought this divine consciousness. He brought this clear perception of a true relationship with God, which these priests, even though they pretended to have it, did not have it at all. He was an absolute reproach to everything that they stood for, and he was gathering energy and commitment and force against what they were about. He drove the money changers from the temple. He showed a power over the elements of this world, including death itself, healing the lame, making the blind see, raising the dead, calling Lazarus out of the tomb. And here are the priests who, in their position, their hereditary position of power, their long-established reality of what their teaching was and how it had to be expressed and what God wanted of his people. And then this one man is moving through. And they feel not only is he upsetting their world, but he's drawing undue attention to themselves, and at least they persuade themselves that maybe the whole Jewish people are threatened because this man is going to attract the attention of the powers, the worldly powers that have control over their life there. They're a conquered people. So they persuade themselves that, oh, this isn't just about a threat to our position. It's a threat to all of us. Plus these sacred traditions that he's violating. Now just imagine how much time they had to spend building up to that. How many encounters there were, how many times they argued with him. I'm sure they sent their best debaters to meet him in the temple. They thought of their best arguments, how they could show him this time to be wrong. They talked about him among themselves, and this fear and hatred and determination is building and building and building and completely self-justified. No question in their minds. Better, the high priest said, that one man should die for the people. He's a threat to all of us. We have to get rid of him. Okay. And then, of course, you have Jesus' disciples. Those who have seen this man who came out of, you know, nowhere, just appears in their lives, grows up with them, but is of such a different order. And he is responding. The call of aspiring love is how we put it in the Festival of Light. A prayer of love went up from earth and God responded. Now, think of the longing in the heart of every one of those disciples who was touched by the Master, who deeply and truly wanted something other than what was being given to them. Now, it's not hard for us to relate to that reality at all, is it? Because that's exactly how we feel. Whether it's for our Guru Bhais who've come and rescued us, for the coming of Master by whatever means he reached you, through Swami Kriyananda, through Kriya Yoga. Everyone has a story. But somewhere in there, a prayer of love went up from the hearts of all mankind, a prayer of aspiring love, aspiring for an experience more profound than anything else we could find. Now, in the life of Jesus, that manifested in his person. He's there in the temple teaching. He's at the dinner table with people that you know. He's walking through the streets. You have the opportunity to speak or to see him or to touch his robe. And people talk about Lazarus was dead and Jesus came and Lazarus came out of the tomb. And the next time you see him, you're thinking, Lazarus came out of the tomb. And we hear that this man who'd been blind since birth and everybody in town knew that he was blind and now he's walking around and he can see. And we say, he healed the blind man. How did he do that? And one way or another, each of those disciples is touched. And they're touched not in an external, isn't this interesting way, but in something that is just so unmistakably true that they are pulled from the life they were living into this completely other reality, whether they follow him, whether they question him, but they cannot repudiate the influence that he has. There he is. And they know increasingly that the religious authority that has power over all of them is increasingly angry about him. And so these two levels are happening at the same time. The disciples are becoming more and more enamored, and each one in his own way is trying to extricate himself from the force of delusion to follow this light. And almost at the same time that the disciples have more and more opportunity, the power against Jesus rages. And all of these realities exist at the same time. And in the midst of it, Jesus himself. On one level, he incarnates in a human body. Swamiji and all the masters remind us over and over again that it wouldn't serve as any kind of real example if the master didn't totally embrace the reality of human life. One of the ways that I've often thought about it is I've visited a few times in a maximum security prison in which people are very deeply incarcerated with no possibility of coming out of that prison until there's a complete resolution of whatever it is that drew them in. And going into such a prison, you go through stage after stage of locking doors, and door closes behind you before the door in front of you opens, and you can bring nothing in with you except a very few items specified. You have to dress a certain way, so many conditions. And once you're deep inside of it, you can only get out by following all those same processes backwards. Very much like we find ourselves incarnated in a human body, isn't it? You know, we take that body and then it has to grow up, and we're bound by the culture, and we're bound by how we're raised, and we're bound by our prenatal conditioning, and we're bound by the decisions that we make, and step by step by step we come deeper and deeper and deeper into this state of delusion until we recognize finally our confinement and begin to try to understand what it will take for us to move back through all of those limiting conditions into freedom. Now, when the master comes, we stand imprisoned by all of the wrong ideas that we have. our identification with this, our desire for that, our attachment to this, our self-definition. We have a little bit of a relationship with God, but we're more trying to draw Him into our reality instead of abandoning our self-definitions and embracing the infinite. But every so often, deep into that prison, some soul just walks in. He walks through all those locks. He's not sent there. He has the power at any moment to walk out, but he doesn't. He lives there with us. And he takes on all the conditions that bind us, not because he has to, but because he loves us. And he hears that call of aspiring love. I aspire for more than this. And then he shows us how, even within that prison, we can find our way to freedom. Now, the story of Jesus, arrested, scourged, humiliated, ultimately crucified. And in the midst of it, all of these things are going on. Peter has the courage to follow him in to where this tribunal is meeting, but he hovers on the edge. And every time somebody spies him and says to him, "Aren't you part of what he is doing?" And then Peter looks at what Jesus is being subjected to, and he just can't. He can't embrace it. He comes back. But in the moment, he loses the thread. So you have Peter, you know, one of the most deeply devoted disciples, still being challenged beyond his ability to hold steady. And then you have all those forces of evil that have finally sort of gotten a hold, symbolized literally by getting a hold of Jesus and by binding him and seemingly to have power over him. And then you have Jesus in the middle of it, either saying nothing at all, not even deigning to answer, to the point where Pilate, and here's poor Pilate, who has nothing really to do with this. He's neither a corrupt priest nor a disciple, but destiny has brought him into contact with this man. And he wants to free him. His wife has warned him, have nothing to do with the condemnation of this man. Pilate himself senses a power here that he doesn't really want to oppose, but he doesn't really have the strength to follow what he feels. So he keeps trying to get Jesus to rescue him. Jesus never, not for a split second in any of this, ever loses the absolute power of God, of which he is the perfect manifestation. He's deep in the prison. He's deep in the chaotic, bound world in which all of us live, but he never loses touch with who he really is. Even as Pilate is trying to tell him, Pilate becomes so frustrated, "Don't you understand?" He feels the only reason Jesus can be so surrendered to his fate is because he must not understand. Pilate says, "Everyone kowtows to me. Everyone sees my power and responds to it. Don't you understand?" And then Jesus just so calmly, so completely, without the slightest hesitation, "You only have power over me because my Father in heaven has given it to you." "Are you a king?" Pilate says. "If my kingdom," he said, "was of this world," he said, my people would have fought," he said, "but this world really has nothing to do with me. You know, I live from a completely other reality." So we go through this story You know, we live through it, through the fantastical words of the Bible and these beautiful songs of Master and of Swamiji, so beautifully given to us by the devotees here. You know, each word of which awakens us to all these many levels of reality, all happening at the same time, historically in the story, but of course always, always happening in our own hearts. We are all of them, potentially. We are the loyal disciple who never wavers, Mary Magdalene, John, Mary herself, Jesus' mother, you know, who stand at the base of the cross and watch as the purest and most perfect being that they have ever imagined even existing, this incarnation of pure love, is destroyed seemingly by this evil. You know, how bewildering. What an extraordinary test of their own ability to be like Jesus himself, even in the face of all that, not to waver, but to believe what they've experienced and to believe in him. And there, you know, even as he's dying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, a moment also for the disciples, because they're watching him die. They're watching him act out the ultimate reality of this prison that we all share, which is sooner or later our life itself is taken away from us. And in this case, without nobility, without beauty, without preparation, without the capacity for them to minister to him. But in the midst of that, they watch him be everything that they know him to be. You know, concerned entirely for the welfare of all those who are doing this to him. And in that, he communicates above all to his own disciples. You see? Even in such a moment. And then, of course, in the last, he looks to his mother. And, you know, we can only speculate as to what the vibration between them must have been. But even in that last hour, yet again, where is his consciousness? And he looks at his disciple, and he looks at his mother, and he unites them. You know, to the last moment, his concern is for others, for those who have hurt him, and for those who have loved him equally. And then when that was done, when John and Mary were united, and from that day the disciple made a place for her in his home, and Jesus knew that. Then Jesus is finished. And now what they see is that he just pulls out of his body. And the story goes on to say, you know, no one died that quickly from crucifixion. And they wanted to hasten the death of people because it was coming into the Sabbath and they needed to have this done. So they went to break the legs of those who were being crucified because that would hasten the collapse, and they would die more quickly. But they went to Jesus, and Jesus was already gone. And again, for the disciples, watching, first of all, he was gone. You know, this had ended in a way that none of them could have anticipated. You know, none of them expected it, nor did they expect him to die. Something else was going to happen. But also, they all realized that he hadn't been killed, he had withdrawn. And so all of the faith, even though now it has taken this completely bewildering form, But all of the faith they have in him is verified. Even before the resurrection, all of the faith they had in him is confirmed by the way he carries himself in this last moment. You know, this is why we read this story over and over and over and over and over and over, and each time it just lives in front of us, because it's our own heart. It's our own destiny. It's our own story. I was standing on this porch here, and there's a Methodist church across the street. And I suppose it's always been there, but I have to say I never saw it. On the roof of that church, there's a very narrow spire, and way up at the top of the spire, there's an extremely plain cross. So it towers, you know, way above the buildings around it. Just so simple. It really could not be any simpler. And I was thinking how many hundreds and hundreds of years that symbol has reached up to the sky and stood above the landscape around it in countless countries and countless places to remind us, you know, just that much to remind us of all that that represents and to give us the courage, you know. One day life is joyous. One day everything that we believe in and everything that we are is being challenged. The next day it's joyous. The next day it's being challenged. Jesus, always the same. The vision of the divine, the heart surrender to the infinite. Even now, you would have no power over me, except that my Father in heaven has given it to you. When Peter fights against his arrest, Jesus said, "Why would I not drink the cup that God has given me?" Never for a moment losing awareness of who he is, why he was born, who we are, why we were born, how we live, how to live, why to live that way, and ultimately the promise of freedom inherent in following that path. We're going to end now with the purification ceremony.